And good afternoon, everyone. We are going to go in order of our agenda today, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 446 and call forward Senator Courtney.
Thank you, Chair Wilson. I'm Peter Courtney, a state senator from District 17, which is here in the Salem Kaiser area. I come to you today in support and one of the chief sponsors of the Senate Bill 446 A. Engrossed, which came out of the Senate Rules Committee, of which I'm a member, vice chair, as well as the Senate. And I believe, I don't have the exact vote count, I know it came out of the committee without dissent, and I'm pretty sure it came off the Senate floor without dissent, if I'm not mistaken. This is a remarkable piece of legislation because I don't know much, and I know you know that, when it comes to things like real estate and things, but I ran across this concept, and this bill tries to do in a discussion I had with a former state representative who has his own real estate firm and company over in Baker City. And he alluded that back in the 99 session, Chair Wilson, a bill was introduced a lot like this, but it was called Senate Bill 182, and it didn't make it. And a lot of effort had gone into it, a lot of heavy lifting, but it just didn't work out. And I got in contact with the real estate commissioner, Scott Taylor, who sits behind me, as well as to get together with the Oregon Association of Realtors and started to work during the interim. When I say started to work, I'm not the one who did any of the nuts and bolts work, but I, you know, just sort of working with the parties and working very hard in the interim to see if, from the association standpoint, the industry standpoint, as well as the state agency standpoint, we could come up with a piece of legislation that's much needed, because it's my understanding that the real estate law that exists in this state, specifically ORS 696, have really not been updated since 1977, and that's not that long ago. But when you consider how much life has changed since then in the real estate world as well as in our world, that is a long time ago. In addition, it's my understanding, and now I am reading from documents just briefly presented to me by Scott Taylor, who has done a wonderful job as a real estate commissioner, that a great deal of what's in ORS 696, Mr. Chair, predates World War II. So there is much need here from a broker standpoint, a real estate agent standpoint, from a professional standpoint, to update this massive piece of legislation which speaks to a very dynamic industry. And all the parties literally came together, and it was, if you look at who co-sponsored and chief sponsored this bill, you'll see it's a DR mix, you'll see it's a House-Senate mix, as well as on the part of the association. They brought together all their people, and I will tell you, it wasn't easy. It was not easy. And poor Scott Taylor, he worked and worked and worked, and we came together, and I think that's reflected in the work that was done in the Senate in terms of the vote in committee and the vote on the Senate floor. Having said that, I just learned at 11:30 today, called off the Senate floor, and I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar, proud of it, I'm a lawyer, that there is a certain section of the bar that has sent a little message by way either of email or a letter that says they have some problems with the bill. Now, that's fine. This is the legislative process. This is a bicameral legislature. In talking to Bob Olson up in the Senate Judiciary Committee, where I just came from, and he referred to the document, and I did not read it, I cannot tell whether or not the letter is referring to the original 446 or amendments or where it is, or whether or not a great deal that that letter is concerned with has been taken care of. But I do have to tell you that we were not aware of those concerns, nor were they brought to our attention. Not that that doesn't mean you shouldn't bring them up over in the Senate side. And we have been working on this through the 99 session, the entire interim, as well as up to this point in the session. So I just want to put that statement on the record. It is a bipartisan effort. It is a massive piece of legislation. It is much needed in the real estate industry world. I really sincerely hope that you can find a way to work with, if there are still concerns, I know the parties are willing to work on them, but I really do think this is a piece of legislation that's long overdue. We do need it, and I really appreciate you letting me come up and testify and make that really very generic statement that doesn't speak to the details or nuts and bolts of the bill.
Thank you, Senator. We'll find some others here, I'm sure, will want to do that. So thank you.
Thank you very much. It's his way of saying, Peter, you don't know what's in the bill. I'm not going to embarrass you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Devlin.
I did want to apologize for being late, particularly for missing the first part of my mentor's presentation.
Well, we'll leave that up to him as to whether he wants to extend forgiveness.
Easter.
All right, very good, thank you. And from the Oregon Association of Realtors, Jim, Carol, and Andrea, please.
Chair Wilson, is this on? Yeah, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jana Jarvis. I'm a little lower on the list, but I'm here primarily to introduce the group that's meeting before you today. This is part of the coalition that Senator Courtney referred to when he talked about how many months we had worked on this particular bill. And they've each got different pieces of the story to tell you and to be able to address any of the concerns that you have, particularly with the email that you may have received today. And with that, I'd like to introduce you to Carol DeJoie at my far right. Carol's the president of the Oregon Association of Realtors for 2001. Jim Homolka, who's president of REMAX Equity. And behind me and up here shortly is Andrea Bushnell. She's our executive vice president.
I'm sure that one thing that we would like to go over today is really what brings this about. And it, for the unlearned in issues of real estate, it appears to be a rather sweeping, wholesale variety of change. And we'd just like to know from whence it came and the intended purposes where we want to go with it.
Chair Wilson, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to be here today. The Oregon Association of Realtors is a nonprofit trade association, represents approximately 13,000 members statewide, and OAR is pleased that you allowed us to come to give testimony in favor of Senate Bill 446. During the Oregon Association of Realtors 2000 Legislative Conference in May, the Oregon Association of Realtors members identified a number of issues which they determined would be potentially beneficial to pursue legislatively. OAR's 2000 President Mike Hoover appointed a Presidential License Law Task Force in which I participated as the President-elect of OAR. The License Law Task Force consisted of members from throughout the state of Oregon. Small and large brokers were represented, rural and urban interests were represented, and License Law Task Force included both brokers as well as sales associates. We also had representation from a member in the education community, one of the real estate schools who was on that task force with us. The License Law Task Force met during the summer to discuss and come up with additional recommended legislative policies to be presented to the OAR Board of Directors in October 2000. Out of those meetings, the License Law Task Force determined a number of policies which the members wanted to see implemented through OAR-initiated legislation. Members of the License Law Task Force then met with the Commissioner Scott Taylor and other representatives of the real estate agency to ensure that we had the support of the agency. In fact, a number of the revisions presented in Senate Bill 446 were originated by the agency, debated, and accepted by our members. The policies identified by the License Law Task Force in conjunction with the agency were noticed to the Board of Directors in September of 2000. 1 month later, the Board of Directors debated and ultimately accepted the policies identified for the License Law Task Force with one exception that does not appear in Senate Bill 446. During the summer and fall of 2000 and the winter of 2001, the Oregon Association of Realtors made a concerted effort to ensure that OAR's members had every opportunity to hear of the proposed policy changes and have input into the process. As the current president of OAR, I personally appeared at meetings in several areas to discuss the changes. Other members of the task force, including Dave Cook, who was the task force chairman and the 2001 president-elect of OAR, also took the opportunity to meet with and discuss with our members the proposals found in Senate Bill 446. Finally, OAR's executive vice president, Andrea Bushnell, attempted to travel to all the boards to present and discuss the proposed policy amendments. There's been significant debate among our members, and not every one of the approximately 13,000 members likes every aspect of Senate Bill 446. However, OAR does have a process that works, and it really does need to be respected. The representative board of directors approved the policies which appear in Senate Bill 446, and as a result, the Oregon Association of Realtors supports Senate Bill 446. Thank you for allowing me to give testimony.
Chair Wilson and committee. I'm Jim Homolka. I'm president of REMAX Equity Group in the Portland area, and we have a fairly large firm, 15 offices, about 700 salespeople. I've been a real estate broker for about 24 years, and prior to that in sales in the business for 27. This bill is a bill that I was personally involved in the task force in forming this bill to help upgrade the law, the education requirements, and the accountability of sales associates. In today's world, with the increase in communication, people are doing business in various places, not necessarily the office, and this increases the education requirements. But it does not do it in an onerous way to the people in the industry right now. It has a 3-year phase in which to complete their education requirements. So I think will be very good not only for the industry, but it will help the people in the business now do business in a better and a little more professional way. I think the requirements are good. They're something that will help the consumer, but will not be onerous on the brokerages, and it will phase in and help. And help overall the real estate industry. And I thank you for letting me testify.
Chair Wilson and members of the committee, my name is Andrea Bushnell. I'm the Executive Vice President and General Counsel for the Oregon Association of Realtors. I appreciate your allowing me to be here today as well. Senate Bill 446 accomplishes many goals of importance to the real estate industry. Of primary importance is to update ORS 696, Oregon's real estate licensing law, which quite frankly does not reflect current business practices in the state. For example, ORS 696 presumes sub-agency, a concept which is no longer practiced due to the passage of buyer agency in 1993. Before the advent of buyer agency, sales agents' primary duties included procuring a buyer for a property, the listing of which belonged to the broker, regardless of which agent procured the listing on behalf of the broker principal. The sales associate worked as a sub-agent of the broker with no fiduciary responsibilities to the buyer. Now, the sales agent or associate works directly as the agent for the buyer and owes to the buyers all the fiduciary duties which are currently set forth in 696.855. The sales associate today is held to a much higher standard than in previous years when the sales associate's sole responsibility was to the broker. The sales associate, in fact, works much like only a broker did prior to 1993. In response to those increased responsibilities facing sales agents today, Senate Bill 446 requires that all current sales agents take better focused education and in the process upgrade their licenses to a broker's license. The goal, ultimately, of that is to have a better educated, more professional industry, which is a benefit not only to the real estate industry, but to the public and the consumers as well. Senate Bill 446 updates various other provisions of ORS 696, which are not reflective of current or even good business practices. Again, by the way of example, in 1993, the legislature adopted ORS 696.830. The agency disclosure form, which was dictated by this statute, is not practical to use. I know this is one of the concerns that was raised in the letter that you all received this morning, is that we were doing away with this great form which talked about agency. And there are many problems with the form, and who was to know in 1993 when they first came up with this idea that it wouldn't in practical use work. And one of the reasons it doesn't work is that it forms an agency relationship within a very few minutes of the consumer and the agent coming together. And many times, most often, it's not the agents who are not trying to use the form, but rather it's the consumer who says, now wait a minute, I know you're telling me this isn't a contract. It says it's not a contract up at the top, but I don't believe you because it reads and it looks like a contract, and so we're not gonna sign it. So you just take that back, put it back in your file, and don't bother us again. The problem with that is that on the back of that initial agency disclosure form is all the information that the consumer needs to be well-versed in what agency is. And so they're not getting the education that they should be getting, even if the agent is trying to discuss the concepts of agency with them. The other thing is that the back of that form actually restates the agency laws as they're stated in statute, which are not always as instructive as plain English might be. So what we've proposed in this, in Senate Bill 446, is something far different and really far better, I think. We're proposing that they, that with every contact, first contact, no matter whether it's on the telephone, electronic transmission, face-to-face, it doesn't matter how that contact originally takes place, but with every contact that takes place, the agent would be required to give to the prospective consumer, the prospective buyer or seller, a pamphlet that clearly, in plain English, discusses what agency is, what the consumer should be able to expect from their agent, and what the agent should, the duties and fiduciary duties that the agent will be required to give to that particular consumer. I think this is a far, far better way of going about getting the message out than the current form. Now, it says that there is no obligation in this letter that you got this morning. It says there's no obligation to prove that the consumer received this particular pamphlet or disclosure document, if you will. That's simply not true, because even though there's not going to be an obligation for the consumer to sign, which, by the way, they don't sign the documents that are given today because they don't want to, because it reads like a contract, but the agent still would have an obligation to give that pamphlet, and if they fail to do so and fail to keep minutes or notes or a tear-off portion in their file that shows who they gave it to, the date and time, they're going to be subject to sanctions by the agency. And so I think that despite this letter on that particular issue, that there are going to be protections built into this particular form, and I think that the consumer is going to be much better off at the end result, at the end of the day. Excuse me. There are many other positive aspects to Senate Bill 446 which our members believe are important and necessary in order to, for them to ensure best business practices in a fair and regulatory environment. And I think that I would like to go through some of those, because some of the benefits that we see are exactly what the letter that you received this morning in opposition stated as problems with this bill. Broker supervision is one of them. Right now, the way we have it set up, you can have one or three or five designated brokers who are responsible for all the agents. And probably Jim can address this better than anybody about how that works in practice. What Senate Bill 446 envisions is it allows one designated broker to be assigned supervision and control authority and to bear sole responsibility and subsequent liability for the people that they are assigned to. So if you're in a large firm, and let's say you have 15 DRs, designated principal brokers, if you will, they would have certain agents who are still, even though they would be brokers now under the new licensing system, those brokers would still be responsible to a supervising broker. The only time that you wouldn't be responsible to a supervising broker would be, one, if you were a DR yourself, or two, if you had enough education to be able to hang out your own shingle and you were practicing as a sole practitioner. Other than that, you still have to abide by some supervision, which isn't contained in Senate Bill 446. So if you are a DR, or if you're practicing as a sole practitioner, what that tells me is that you've gone through the courses, you've taken the appropriate tests, and supposedly you're well educated enough to actually be acting without supervision. And that's no different than the law is today. If you can take the courses and you can pass the test, you can supervise yourself and you can supervise others. So nothing really changes in that respect. The licensing system revision that I'm referring to really is an important aspect of this bill, because it does require all licensees to ultimately become a broker or a principal broker after an initial three-year, give or take, three-year transition period. And the 30 hours of required coursework to be taken, actually, will be taken in modules and will count towards the agent's current continuing education obligation. So it's not a huge burden on any agents, which I think was one of the original concerns that some of the bigger firms in Portland had in Senate Bill 182. They no longer have that burden, and yet they're going to be required to take much more focused, better quality education. They will be better equipped to handle the real estate industry as it exists today. We're not practicing in the same environment that we practiced 20 years ago or even 10 years ago. It's much more regulated. It's much more difficult. They have much higher responsibilities to their principals, primarily their buyers. And so all agents need to be prepared to act as brokers, because in effect, I can tell you that as the statute is written today, most sales agents today actually act as brokers, not intentionally breaking the law. It's the way the business has evolved. So if they're going to act as brokers, by gosh, they should be educated and be equipped to actually function in that capacity. So that's another thing that we think is extraordinarily important on this. Designated agency was one of the things that this particular letter in opposition addressed, and what they said was designated agency is trying to get away from or is disguising dual agency. Well, the fact of the matter is that the statute today does not reflect anywhere the term dual agency. We talk about in-company transactions, which is in effect a disclosed dual agency, but designated agency isn't meant to take that away at all. Designated agency is meant, in fact, to give the consumer better representation. And how that works is right now, when you have an in-company transaction, a disclosed dual agency, the buyer and the seller are both represented by people from the same company. What you have now is, okay, buyer and seller started out not as a disclosed dual agency. Now they're interested in the property. They are in a disclosed dual agency situation. Each person who is representing that buyer and seller is now required to say, hold on here, I know that I owed you all of these fiduciary duties in the beginning, but now that we're an in-company transaction, I represent both the seller and the buyer, even though perhaps I don't even know the agent because the firm is big, I certainly don't know the seller that I supposedly represent now. But I have to limit my fiduciary duties to you now because we're an in-company transaction. And designated agency is simply meant to say, no, the broker maintains that position as the designated agent or the disclosed dual agent, and each of the individual agents continues to owe 100% of their original fiduciary duties to the buyer or the seller, depending on whom they were representing in the first place. So this letter really does misunderstand the concept of designated agency, so I wanted to make that quite clear today. excuse me. Another part of the letter in opposition that you got today talks about substituting common law agency duties with weaker statutory duties. I don't know whether the drafter of this letter read the version of the A.N. Gross version of the statute or the proposed statute or not. But the reality is that the statutory duties that are specifically expressed in sections 47, 48, and 49, no, excuse me, 45, 46, and 47, actually are very specifically addressed to include all of those original common law duties, and in fact are more specific than the common law duties are. In other words, what we're trying to do is set standards so the agents know what their responsibilities and their obligations are, and the consumers know what they can expect from their agents. And so I think it's very important to know that we're not trying to propose weaker statutory duties. We're incorporating common law duties into the statute, and we're actually making them even more specific than the common law duties were in the first place. Let me see here. Another aspect of this letter, it says that the Senate Bill 446 eliminates a broker's vicarious liability for the acts of the agents he or she supervises, thus insulating the brokers for inadequate oversight of the agent's actions. This bill does not do that, not at all, in fact. When we talk about vicarious liability, and when we talk in terms of in section 52, 51 and 52. What we're talking about here is that there is a mutual ability not to have imputed liability on the part of the consumer or the principal. So we've made it even across the board. And the reason we do that is that right now, both the principal and the agent can be held liable for actions of the principal or the agent, depending on which side you're on, without ever even knowing what has occurred. Let me give you an example of this. You have, for example, an agent who represents a buyer and takes a buyer out to see seller's property. Buyer likes the seller's property, decides to go back at a later date. The buyer drives up, the seller is outside of the property, says, oh, you know, come on in, let's take a look at what's going on here. You know, I'd like to show you around. During the course of this communication between the seller and the buyer, the seller says, oh yes, there was an underground storage tank, it's been decommissioned. Well, in fact, what the seller means is that there's an underground storage tank that they quit using 15 years ago and they left all the gas in it or the oil in it. And so it's sitting out there, but the seller's now said it's decommissioned. Well, perhaps the seller's agent or the buyer's agent don't even know that there was a tank ever in existence there. And so now you have a representation by a seller to a buyer that the buyer is relying on. And guess who can be held liable for that? The agent can be held liable for that, even though they didn't know about the representation at all. Now, by the same token, this protects the consumer in the same way. If the agent makes a representation that the principal doesn't know about and can't know about, they cannot be held liable for the misrepresentation of that agent in the same way that the agent can't be held liable for a misrepresentation of their principal. So that's what we're talking about. We're not talking here, as this letter indicates, about trying to illuminate a broker's vicarious liability for the acts of their own agents. That is not what we're trying to do. And in fact, in the broker supervision provisions, it does just the opposite. It reaffirms the obligations to work under a supervisory situation. This proposed legislation is lengthy. It is complicated. But I absolutely disagree that it's anti-consumer. I think it does just the opposite. I see this as a win-win for the consumer, for the agents practicing, as well as for the real estate agency. And I'll, of course, let Scott Taylor talk to that himself when he comes up for his own testimony. But those are all the reasons why we support Senate Bill 446, and we certainly would appreciate your consideration and passage out of the committee today. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Just a question. In the formulation of this proposed legislation, did you bring in legal help of your own to work on that?
Well, Chair Wilson, I am an attorney myself. I did work on this. We have
several people involved recently.
We did, actually. We had three attorneys who looked at it off and on. We had outside counsel who looked at it as well. Not in an official capacity, but rather as a capacity as part of the work group.
And I didn't mean to slight you, obviously.
No, but
there's wisdom in a multitude of counselors on these things.
I understand.
Why I ask. All right. Rest of the committee, do you have any questions of these? Representative Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Specifically to the issue of common law statutory rights, those were apparently addressed in Section 49A, the amendments to Senate Bill 446,
yes,
and weren't part of the original version.
Let me, quite frankly, I don't remember the original version, but let me pull the appropriate sections here of the engrossed bill. In Section 45 of the A engrossed Senate Bill 446, you can see that what the bill said originally was the seller's agent has an affirmative obligation to the seller, the fiduciary duties of loyalty, obedience, disclosure, confidentiality, reasonable care, and diligence, and accounting and dealings with the seller. And all of those aspects are included in the new language. That's true for Section 45 and 46, as well as 47, which 40. 5 deals with a seller's agent, Section 46 deals with a buyer's agent, and Section 47 deals in an in-company transaction.
Okay. Further questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Taylor, please. Welcome to committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Scott Taylor. I'm the Oregon Real Estate Commissioner, and I'm speaking today in support of this bill. Before I begin my remarks, and I'm not going to make them too lengthy, hopefully, I think I can answer Representative March's question. Most of the amendments that were in the A and Gross version, Representative March, were primarily housekeeping measures where there were small things that didn't quite get through the translation as well as we thought they would. The designated agency portion of the bill was in the original bill.
Thank you.
Ms. Bushnell mentioned that this process began quite some time ago. Specifically, the process began in October of 1997, and that process resulted in the formulation of Senate Bill 182, which failed last session. That committee that worked on that bill consisted of attorneys, consisted of the real estate board, which does include members of the public, a number of members of the industry from all walks of the industry, both demographically and geographically, and included folks who were large companies, companies that would practice what we're talking about, designated agency today, single agent brokers who may only represent sellers or may only represent buyers. So there was a wide group of people that participated in that endeavor, which led to the first bill. Part of the problem we have with our current statute, it was mentioned that many of the things that are in statute came about before World War II, which is true. The last time the bill was really rewritten was in Sunset Review in 1977. And I started in the business in 1976, and I can tell you from what we saw in the business then to today, you wouldn't recognize the business. And yet we're still trying to work with a statute that reflects what was going on during that period in history. There are a number, over the years, the bill has been amended, cobbled, whatever you want to call it, but there's a number of conflicts within the bill that make it very difficult to function at least administratively. And I'm going to give you one example that was an unintended consequence that happened last session. There was a bill that was passed last session that allowed the agency to enter into reciprocal agreements with other states and do so by rule. During that, what did not get repealed was, and that's found today in 696-265, 696-258 didn't get repealed, and 258 basically says a reciprocal licensee has to do all the pre-licensing, the post-licensing requirements of an Oregon licensee, which contradicts what the essence of reciprocity is. Therefore, basically what it did was make it impossible for the agency to enter into those agreements after we'd already entered into about 8 of them. Now, why do we really care about that? Part of the problem is if you look at Oregon, you'll see that there are three states that border on Oregon, that a lot of the population center of Oregon bounds on those states and their markets cross the state line. If you look at the commercial brokers, they don't work within a state today, they work within the world. They cross national boundaries, they cross state lines. NAFTA even requires it. And the problem that we have as administering agencies is we need to be able to allow our folks to cross state lines so that they can compete, as well as the converse. So we have those sorts of things all through the statute. There's another amendment in 696-290 today that is again one that brokers who are operating internationally have a problem. 696-290 has an exemption that allows a broker to pay a referral fee to a licensed broker in another jurisdiction or country where real estate licensing exists. However, there are countries, emerging nations out of the Eastern Bloc, who have yet to enact real estate licensing laws. Many of the countries that are older countries, in fact, England is one of them, doesn't have a real estate licensing law. Mexico doesn't have a real estate licensing law. The bill amends that statute so that it will allow brokers to pay referral fees to those folks, provided they held themselves out to be a real estate broker in that particular jurisdiction. I could go on and on with conflicts, but I won't.
Let me ask you, I think that the committee understands and appreciates what you're trying to do with this, what the proponents are trying to do with it. Bill, I think maybe before we consider a vote today, we'd like to have you address directly what we've heard from the sole and small firm practice section of the state bar. Are you aware of what we've received today?
Mr. Chair, I received it this morning at about 11:30. I have, I think I can respond to most of them today, and I'll attempt to do that.
Better about the whole thing if we could address those.
So, actually, those are the ones that I was going to cherry pick that I was going to talk to, but I wanted to give you a feel for the overall nature of this bill and why it's so important. Relative to the fiduciary requirements that are currently set out in 696, 805, 810, and 815, the bill or the law today basically sets out the six fiduciary requirements that are very general that are set out in the common law. And what the bill does, and Ms. Bushnell gave you the appropriate sections of the bill that address this, is it doesn't abrogate those very general requirements. In fact, they're still set out there. What it does is expand upon them, and I think it puts it into a context that a real estate licensee can understand what it is that they're supposed to do as it applies to those very general common law obligations, and secondly, so that a member of the public who reads this disclosure pamphlet that's going to come about as a result of this bill will understand what it is that they can expect their licensee to do for them. I think the biggest problem that we see today at the real estate agency in terms of complaints is as a result of unmet expectations. And part of that is because they don't know what the reasonable expectations are. And I believe this bill does that, and I think it does it very well. The next issue that I'll address that was raised was that of disclosed limited agency. Andrea mentioned that there is nothing addressed today in statute regarding dual agency, which is true. Today, what we're calling disclosed limited agency is known as in company. I don't know what that means either. That's kind of a general term that somebody thought of in 1993. The fact of the matter is what's currently happening today and in company is disclosed limited agency. So it's been redefined, and I think it's better set out to where one could understand what it is that a disclosed limited agent does. I think under this proposal, generally, the time that you will see that happening is where you have one individual that's on both sides of the transaction, which is not all that uncommon in our industry. Designated agency is not a new term or terminology if you look at the nation as a whole. And again, and what I'm saying is part of what we're trying to do here is bring our law more in conformance with the rest of the country so folks can operate across state lines without causing too much problems. 20 states now have designated agency. It has a foundation in law. In New Mexico in 1994, as I recall, there was a Supreme Court case known as Bertram versus Moser, which set out the concept of designated agency and found in that particular case that one licensee operating within the firm could be the exclusive agent of a buyer. The other licensee operating within a firm could be the exclusive agent of a seller, and the broker by default would be the dual agent, and this was okay, at least in terms of their statute, and theirs isn't much different than ours, so long as the broker wasn't one of the representatives of either of the parties. Generally, that's what you find today. So that's the foundation of this particular concept. Maine was the first state to enact it. They did so in 1994, and since then, 19 other states have enacted it. I can tell you from my own experience in working with other administrators of state agencies like ours nationwide, this particular method of operating has not been problematic. In fact, it's served to resolve problems because, again, the public has an expectation of the licensee. Their expectation is that licensee is operating for them, and when they find out they aren't, then they're unhappy. So, again, I think what we're trying to do is codify reality. Current statute does not prohibit the use of that. It just does not spell out what the obligations and responsibilities are. There's a fair amount of discussion about the current disclosure form versus the proposed new brochure. With my remarks, I enclosed a copy of the statutory form. I'd like to say that I have a lot of pride of authorship in that. When I was in the private sector, I was a broker in Medford. The form that you see is basically the form that the Medford brokers, and I was among the four that designed that form with counsel, used prior to 1993 because we were practicing buyer agency, dual agency, and seller agency in Southern Oregon prior to the enactment of that law. It was the best we had at the time. If you read it, I think you'll find that it's very confusing. I think you can see how someone would believe that they might be entering into a contract, and I think you would see the problem that the form has used. From an administrative standpoint, since my coming to the agency in 1995, which was a year after the enactment of that agency statute, I can tell you that substantive contact has been a nightmare to enforce. Again, it's not well understood. It's not well defined. And the problem the agency has in enforcing the current statute is a proof problem. I'll take you back to my days. I used to say this somewhat humorously, though it isn't really very funny, is statute now requires that that form that you have be presented at first substantive contact. I think what I found in my office is that I had an awful lot of very good salespeople because typically that form was dated within a day or two of the time they entered into an earnest money agreement. And I know those folks were talking to their clients before then. So it's difficult to enforce. We think a plain language form that requires an acknowledgement at contract that they receive that form with the provisos that the agents are going to have to do their due diligence in terms of documentation is a much better way of doing that so the public understands what it is that they're entering into. When they create a buyer agency agreement or they create a listing, which is a seller agency agreement, that's going to incorporate that in, and their obligations are going to be clearly set out, and they're going to have to operate accordingly. Also in the bill, there is a provision that prior to the entering into of an agency agreement, the licensee will be held to a course of conduct as outlined by that type of agency, depending on who it is that they're working with in that situation. So it crosses over that and enters into it anyway. So I think we have that taken care of. In terms of the supervisory responsibilities, the supervisory responsibilities are there. In fact, I think they're better set out than they are today. Today, those responsibilities can be found in 696.301 sub 29. And that particular section of the statute has been amended, and it better sets out what a supervisor and broker must do, what they're going to be held accountable for, and how they're going to conduct themselves in current statute. Further, with the advent of the licensing change that Andrea mentioned, I think what that's going to do is the individual licensee is responsible to the agency for what it is they do. Today, that's not so clear. So if an agent, a broker, works with buyers and sellers as a listing and selling agent, their function within that transaction, they're going to be directly responsible to the agency for their conduct. the supervisor is going to be directly responsible to the agency for their supervisory conduct. My reg staff can tell you today that often they will interview a salesperson. The salesperson will say something to the effect, well, my broker's responsible for that. They should have picked it up. And if you look at the documentation of the transaction, there's no way the broker would have known. The agent today doesn't know, and in fact, we're enforcing the law that way, that they're responsible for what it is that they're working or their work. And I think this more clearly articulates that. Finally, and I'll take any questions at that point, I think I've addressed everything except vicarious liability, which I think Andrea did very well, so I won't go into that. As you know, the Internet has had an impact on our world. It's really had an impact on this business, and e-commerce has had a tremendous impact on this business, as well as a necessity for digital storage because of the amount of paperwork that brokers now have to maintain for records. That's all dealt with in this particular bill, and we're going to be in a horrible mess if we don't get that through. That would conclude my remarks. I'd take any questions.
Thank you. Do we have any questions? Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 446, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 446. Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 446 A engrossed to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Devlin moves Senate Bill 446 A engrossed to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Do we have any discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Berger.
Not really under discussion. I'm in favor of the bill, but I just wondered if there was a reason why we didn't have any testimony from the writer of the letter.
Couldn't make it.
Okay. I'm always disturbed to get something so last minute and then without testimony as well.
Right. I agree. Representative Doyle.
Thank you. Just reviewing that letter, and I think just what we had on the record, both from the Board of Realtors and from our Real Estate Commissioner, the Association of Realtors, was that I think all those issues had been adequately addressed in the amended version. And it seems to me that even though we may have had some concerns expressed by the State Bar Committee, is that there is, it may be that they were just basing it on the original draft, and that it makes sense based on what they originally saw. I would look that, from just my review of this bill, that it really does bring the regulations of our realtors into the 21st century. It's a good, solid bill. If it turns out that, you know, there's some minor issues that have to be addressed, to me, whatever those may be, are far outweighed by, I think, progress that's being made with this bill.
Thank you. Brother. Jennifer, can you call the roll, please?
Representative
Jackson? Aye.
Representative
Doyle? Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Excuse.
Representative
Larson? Excuse.
Representative March?
Aye.
Representative Star?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Walker?
Aye.
Chair Wilson?
Aye. And motion carries. And anybody like to be a carrier?
Representative Doyle is a carrier. Maybe he didn't.
Representative Doyle is a carrier. Thank you. Appreciate that. We'll close the work session. Senate Bill 446. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2577. Mm-hmm. Let's see who our players are. Hey, John Lindblack, Elections Division. John Lindblack, please. Welcome, John. We're getting a little bit more used to seeing you here. Huh?
Yeah.
welcome, and it's all yours.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm John Lindbeck. I'm Elections Division Director. I'm happy to be here today to talk about House Bill 2577. We're, of course, in support of this legislation. In a nutshell, what this legislation does a couple of things. It repeals the ability of the Secretary of State to grant a routine waiver for folks who don't want to electronically file contribution and expenditure reports. And it requires the implementation of a searchable database of contribution and expenditures for use by the public by March 31st of the year 2000. Now, if you look at the bill in Section 1, Subsection 3, you'll see that there is basically an out clause for somebody that has some sort of serious problem where they're unable to electronically file. The Secretary of State could grant them permission if they can demonstrate some sort of extreme circumstance. Before we get into the details of this bill, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the concept we have at the Division of Elections for a new system for contribution and expenditure filing. As most of you know, I'm new to the job. I'm starting my fifth week. It was pretty clear to me after just 1 week on the job that nobody was particularly happy with the current system as it's developing for C&E electronic filing. And it prompted me to take a fresh look at it. And what you see on the screen, and copies of this PowerPoint presentation have been provided to you, is the sum and substance of a fresh look at the situation. And we would like to take it in somewhat of a new direction. Right now, as most of you know, if you're going to electronically file your contribution and expenditure reports, you're required to get some software that would be compatible with the Division of Elections system, load that on your home computer, figure it out, get trained, have your treasurer do the work, submit the information electronically to the Elections Division. It was pretty clear to me that there were numerous complaints that people just felt that this is too hard. We haven't gotten to the point where it's easy yet. And so I want to talk to you today about a new concept that we're calling simply easy filing. And the challenge in coming up with this was to determine how could the Elections Division improve service to customers by making filing easier, because we're not going to get anywhere in this unless we simplify this process and make it easy for people. We determined that an electronic C&E filing system has to have a series of characteristics in order for it to really work. What do we want the end product to look like? We decided that it needs to be easy to use for both small and big campaigns. It needs to be low cost or free for small, low budget campaigns, because we're not only talking about campaigns for the legislature and statewide campaigns, but we're talking about all campaigns in the state of Oregon. Folks out in special districts and so on, they have needs as well. It needs to be intuitive, so extensive training is not required. It needs to be intuitive in the way that internet banking is intuitive. If any of you have an internet banking account, you're pretty much able to figure it out by going over the internet to the account and working your way through it. And we want a system that is that simple and easy to use. And it needs to be capable of doing the math for the candidates and their campaigns. And we envision something like TurboTax. If you've ever used that system where you go in and you fill in your information, you respond to questions, and then that program actually puts the correct information in the right boxes, does the math for you, and spits out draft forms for you to review. We want something like that that does the math for you and doesn't make that a major issue. We also want a system that's able to catch errors so it actually assists candidates in correct filing. And if any of you have ever gone over the internet and bought a book from Amazon.com or bought an airplane ticket, you know that when you fill in the required boxes, if you don't do it just right, you'll get error messages back. We want a system that will do that for you as candidates. When you or your treasurer are filling in the information, if you don't do it completely, you'll get an error message back. In the long run, that will help us, and of course, it will help you avoid those insufficiency letters that some of you might get and find incredibly irritating. We also want it to be so efficient and easy to use that it provides an incentive to file electronically. You know, laws like this are, like this bill before you, are really quite necessary. Most states across the nation are moving in this direction. We're not inventing the wheel in Oregon, but and that's all fine to require people by law to do it. But what we really want to do is develop an electronic filing system that is so easy to use that it provides you that incentive to go do it on your own, not because you're forced to do it. So we want to move in this direction, and I'm sure a lot of you probably have some ideas of your own that you could add to this list. Yes, sir.
Okay. Thanks, John. I guess the second bullet you have, low cost.
Mm-hmm.
You envision that this new system will cost campaigns, since right now there's no cost to file the CNEs.
What we want is a system that has a no-cost option. And if I go a little bit further in my presentation, I think the onion will, some more layers will be peeled off the onion, and your question will be answered.
Okay.
But we want a no-cost option, and with another option for people who want sophisticated campaign software that will, like, generate your thank you letters and all those other bells and whistles to be fully compatible with this. But as we go further, I think it will become clearer for you.
Representative Devlin.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Perhaps later in your presentation when we actually get to, I don't know if this is an actual depiction of something that's being created or not. No, I have some questions there, but one of the basic concerns I would have is the bill is passed as, you know, a shell, and it's eliminating the waiver. And let's say this bill passes, it does not have an emergency clause and goes in effect 90 days after, and maybe in an optimist world that would affect the supplemental in September, but I tend to doubt it. But there's a shell in there. What if the system isn't working? How by rule can you waive the requirement if you have a shell in here?
Well, we have a system in place now. Some people are electronically filing now, and we will...
I know, but I think, Mr. Chairman, I think some of those people, I don't know if that's entirely, some of those people have been, at least I've talked to one of them, was asked to file electronically and file by paper also because of problems with electronic filing. I mean, I think it would be an excellent system if it could be created, but the difference between this and TurboTax is that, and maybe it's possible to do, and I know previous witnesses on other areas of this talked about people being willing to do this, but, you know, TurboTax probably has a couple of million dollars in development in terms of, different versions of it and developing it. And I don't think you'll develop anything that's so sophisticated that it'll have a little Secretary of State that'll come out and talk to you when you made an error. kind of an interesting.
No, but that's an interesting idea.
Just a little secretary.
Herman's pretty tall, so we can have a little bit taller, little.
through the chair, Representative Devlin. Right now, we have a system that is working in a fashion, but nobody seems particularly happy with it, and we'll have to live with that system until we, you know, move to something better.
Mm-hmm.
The reference to TurboTax, we're not talking about something that is nearly as complicated as TurboTax, and also we're not inventing the wheel, as I said earlier. We have other jurisdictions in the United States that have moved to systems similar to this. One is the state of Ohio, another is the city of San Francisco. We took a look at those and liked what we saw. Ohio's isn't quite as simple as we would want it to be here in Oregon, but they do have some elements to theirs that we would like to, frankly, steal and use, and hope their Secretary of State is willing to allow us to do that.
Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
And also, I mean, myself and my good friend here to the left of me, Representative Starr, would like a system so that we can track contributors and send out letters and things like that, too. And that might be an inappropriate thing to be in a publicly produced system.
Right. As I mentioned earlier, those extra bells and whistles, that's getting into the venue of something that the private providers, vendors, will provide for you. We can't provide, we don't want to get that complicated when we're actually doing that. That's not our goal. If you need those extra bells and whistles, we will work with the vendors to make sure that their systems are compatible with ours, that you could either export data from our system, they could enter it in ours and export it from ours into your campaign software, or do it the other way around. Enter the information first into your campaign software and export it into the state system, if you follow me. If I could, can I continue? If you take a look at the big picture for easy filing, as I said earlier, we want it to be similar to internet banking or TurboTax or Quicken. We want it to be web-based. In other words, the state of Oregon would maintain a website. When you register as a candidate with the elections division, you would be given some sort of electronic signature or PIN number that is to be held confidential by you. And at that website, you would have your own account, and it would be similar to an internet banking account. No one could look at it. No one in the division's elections division could look at it. It would be confidential to you until you choose to make the information available to us. And let me continue, and I'll explain to you how that would work. As I said before, it would have an internet banking level of security. Campaigns, your treasurers would have simple screens, one for contributions, one for expenditures. And you would go to the screen and you would fill in the required information, much as you do now when you go to a screen on the internet and buy that book from Amazon.com or buy that plane ticket. That information would be entered into your secure account. If the information is entered incorrectly or it's incomplete, error messages would point out problems to you so that we would catch those problems, help you catch those problems up front. To prepare a report, the campaign would click a button and the information would be transferred to the proper forms, complete with correct calculations, much like the TurboTax does now. That's the best way of explaining it, I think, if you've ever used that program. With a click of the mouse, the reports could be electronically transferred and registered with the Elections Division, but of course you would be able to print out drafts and review them before you chose to do that. So here's a an example of a sample screen that could possibly be used. You see at the top, you fill in the name of the contributor, the address, other kinds of information that's required, the check number, the amount. And then when you come to the next contribution, a new screen pops up and you do it all over again. And it will register that information into your respective accounts. For campaigns that want to use, as I said before, vendor-provided software, the reports could be transferred electronically and dumped into the state system. One of the key elements of making this work is to make sure that the vendor software out there and the state system, those are compatible with one another. So the benefits for easy filing, as envisioned here, that it's, number one, it would truly be easy to use. It would cut down on reporting errors. It would be the first step towards developing a CNE database for the public, which is part of this bill. I mean, we don't get to that part until we solve this part. You don't get to that searchable database until this part is truly solved and people are able to file that information easily. And it eliminates manual entry of information by the Elections Division. Right now, that information that the division is getting in on paper eventually has to be manually entered for the production of our summary reports. So that completes my presentation today, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We have questions. Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question on why we need to repeal the ones in Section 3 of the bill, you repeal the law.
on if it's in section 3, is it the same exact wording in section 1, sub 3? Are we repealing or?
I have a copy of section 8 of the waiver. I could read it to you if you would like.
Well, the only thing that looks different to me is the sunset clause on section 8 is January 1, 2004. That seems to me to be the major change.
That's right.
Mr. Turgis, could I follow up?
Yeah, follow.
Now, that waiver, I mean, the stuff, information we have says that, where did I read it, 28 out of 28 campaigns, 22 campaigns across elections out of 198 filed electronically. So I guess the rest of them were granted a waiver or filed wrong without the waiver, like some campaigns I know.
Yes, that's true, and that's a sign to me that not just that people don't want to do it, but we haven't gotten to that point where it's easy enough to give people the incentive to do it. We want to change that direction.
So my concern is, Mr. Chair, is that are we really doing away with the waiver? Is it going to be as simple as, let's say, the last cycle it was for those campaigns that when you know, set up to do it electronically, if the state system isn't up to snuff, what's the waiver scenario, the question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, I think that's a good question because I asked that question myself internally. The intent here, the feeling was that we needed a section like that to deal with extraordinary circumstances, but the intent here is to require filing unless the circumstances, you know, present an extreme problem. Frankly, I can't think of one right now when I think about conditions under which we would grant a waiver, but I'm, you know, keeping an open mind.
Just one last, it ties in with what Representative Devlin was talking before. I mean, I would guess in the event that this system that you're talking about, if this system were to be online, that'd be great, and there would be no need for a waiver. In the event that the system doesn't get there in time, you know, we move the sunset date, you know, you're saying no waivers granted, I see a problem there. Now, I guess Secretary of State, if the system doesn't get up and running, can just, you know, grant waivers because it's impractical for people to use it. So in certain, right. at a certain level, I guess, we're giving the Secretary of State more leeway in determining how these things will be filed, I guess, is the bottom line.
I do want the committee to know that I don't have any intention to move this today, but it is an interesting idea. I think a good concept, a tad in front of its time here, but obviously, you need to get the cart and the horse relationship set here before you move ahead. So my feeling on it would be before we would go to a work session on this, we'd want to obviously get together with you and discuss the chronology of how this would unfold and so forth. Representative March, I think you had a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lindbeck, the revenue associated your office said it would have approximately a $13,000 in savings. It seems to me that figure might be a little low if this indeed catches a lot of the errors before they are submitted to you, because there's a lot of review, and frankly, my campaign is guilty as anybody else's, I'm sure, of missing a line, leaving out in-kind whatever, and the software presumably would not allow that. So is that a number that you folks would like to revisit and see if there's a little more savings available?
Through the chair, Representative March, that number is based, right now we hire some temporary help to come in and manually input data. That number is based on the elimination of those contracts for the manual entry of data.
But none of the other potential savings in your office, maybe you folks could come up with that number. Thank you.
Good luck,
Representative Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, this almost sounds like a request that in development of software like this, a couple of things that would be beneficial is obviously by your table here was not clear, your brief presentation. I would assume that your software would do aggregates also, which is always an interesting issue. And it might also be beneficial, now this is going a little ways, I understand that, Mr. Chairman, if you could put the ID number in for a PAC and if it would automatically identify the PAC and address, et cetera. The reason being is if you look in your reports for your primary and general elections, people often list the same political action committee differently throughout those reports. That's because a lot of times they don't know what the official name is of the PAC committee, so they try to take what's off the check, or somebody tells them what the PAC committee is, or something else. But it's often difficult to determine what the actual name is, and if you go through the reports, you can just pick them out. But that's the same committee, but people have referred to it four different ways.
That's a wonderful idea. And those are precisely the kind of ideas that we want to generate a long list of requirements like that. That's one of the processes that's up front when you develop a new system, is to develop those requirements. And obviously we need to talk to as many customers of the elections division as possible, because there are undoubtedly many more good ideas out there.
Thank you for the questions. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate your testimony today. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2577. Open a public hearing on the House Bill 2578. Lynn Rossick, please.
Members of the committee, my name is Lynn Rossick. I'm an assistant attorney general at the Department of Justice. I'm here in my role as the attorney for the Elections Division. They asked me to speak to House Bill 2578, which is a Secretary of State bill. It does a deceptively simple thing, but requires some amount of explanation as to why the Secretary is asking to make this change. There is only one word in ORS 26665 that is proposed to be deleted by this bill. It's in line 8. It's the word fraud. It's only one word, but there are some. I have to give you a little bit of background as to why the Secretary is asking for this. It's not quite as simple as it might seem. The reason that the bill has been proposed is essentially to return Chapter 260 in the election law to the way the Secretary of State understood it to be until relatively recent informal advice from the Attorney General's office that, in fact, the word fraud in the undue influence statute requires the Secretary of State to accept complaints and investigate and penalize false statements in election campaigns. It's a controversial issue that I acknowledge, and we can certainly have that discussion as to whether that's an appropriate role, but it is not one that the Secretary of State has understood himself to have and has a number of consequences for him, and that is the reason he is asking to have the law amended. Just to give you a very short history, back in the I won't say the olden days, but some years ago, the statute on false statements in election laws, there is a specific statute that speaks to false statements in election laws, ORS 26532, was one that was directly enforced by the Secretary of State. It was a misdemeanor to make a false statement, a material false statement in the election laws, and the Secretary of State investigated those and then referred them for prosecution. Then Secretary of State Clay Myers asked the legislature to make that a private right of action. And the reason that he did so, according to the legislative history, is because he told the legislature that he did not think it was an appropriate thing for the Secretary of State to be the truth arbiter, and that was not an appropriate role for the government, and that it was a judicial role in appropriate, limited circumstances for persons that had a specific complaint about a specific falsehood. So that change was made in 1973. In 1978, then Secretary of State Norma Paulus received an informal written opinion from Attorney General Jim Redden that confirmed that there was no longer any role for the Secretary of State in the area of false statements in election campaigns. Because it was a private right of action, which still exists to this day in ORS 26532. More recently, in 1993, the Secretary of State Kiesling received Another letter from the Attorney General that confirmed in a different context that, in fact, that that the undue influence statute 266-65 could not be used for false statements, and that that fraud provision wouldn't be used that way. More recently, the Attorney General has informally advised the Secretary of State that those prior representations from the prior Attorneys General may be incorrect. And that changes the status quo relatively dramatically for the Secretary of State in a way that would really affect both their resources and the role of that office. So basically, although House Bill 2578 is asking the legislature to make a change, it's a change that essentially they're asking to have happen so that the understood role of the Secretary of State would essentially continue the way they've understood it historically for the last 30 years or so. Distinguish here, this does not impact sworn false statements in election law context. And I'm sure you can remember some relatively high-profile cases where persons have made false statements and the required information on candidate filings or on voters' pamphlet information. You'll remember that in order to file voters' pamphlet information, you're required to give some occupational and educational background, and you have to sign that it's true. So that's called required information, and if that is false, it is a Class C felony under a completely different statute, not under the undue influence statute. So that would continue to be enforced. What we're talking about are just anything relating to an election where someone would be able to file a complaint with the Secretary of State's office to say they said something false and it's influencing people to vote one way or the other. Right now, that would be a civil penalty that the Secretary of State would have to investigate, and then the enforcement would be a penalty of up to $250. But as you can imagine, in the context of election law, or in the context of elections and when these things would happen and what would be the political atmosphere around the complaint and the response to it, it's going to be a highly charged matter. It's going to be difficult for the Secretary of State to be in that venue. It's not a venue they've been in previously, and I guess the reason for the bill is to request that not be something that's imposed on the Secretary through this new interpretation of what the fraud statute means. So I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any. That gives you a little bit of context of why we're asking to delete that word.
Thank you. Question, Representative Walker.
Chair Wilson, thank you. How does this affect statements by third parties that are printed in the voter's pamphlet? Endorsement.
Representative Wilson, Representative Walker, the statement of endorsement is enforced under a separate statute where you have to receive permission. They have to have the form in order to note that the statement of endorsement is there. The statement of endorsement enforcement doesn't really go to truth or falsity. It just has to go to permission being given for the endorsement. And so that would not affect the enforcement that the Secretary of State currently does in that area. This change would not.
And if I understand your testimony correctly, this would not affect any statement of the required statement that is made in the voter's pamphlet?
Chair Wilson, Representative Walker, that's true. That would not be affected at all by this. Change would make it clear that there's not an opportunity to file a complaint with the Secretary of State that the Secretary would have to follow up on, for instance, information in brochures or information on TV ads or things like that, or anything that was just said while a person went door to door or at a political forum.
Follow up.
So I just want to verify then that it does not affect those statements in the voter's pamphlet. This would be outside of the voter's pamphlet?
Chair Wilson, Representative Walker, it does not affect the required information statements in the voter's pamphlet, but those would still be subject to penalties for false statements. But right now, the other information in the voter's pamphlet, the text of it, once you get past the required information, is in the same status as any other sort of political campaigning that would be affected, that would be subject to other kinds of enforcement, but not by the Secretary of State. Thank you.
Any further questions? I see no media here, so, gosh, we obviously won't be tabbed as being one who, a committee that turns a blind eye to fraud. Not down there, are they?
Mr. Chairman, okay. I think this is a consent agenda item.
Actually, I think we ought to have somebody from the Attorney General's office presented, in that they first are the ones that first told us not to enforce it, and now they're telling us to enforce it.
All right. Any further? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Let's go ahead and let me ask, any discussion on this at this point in time?
How soft on fraud are we?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Starr.
At one point, fraud did not mean false statements, and now it does, because that's basically the bottom line.
Any other discussion?
Perhaps I should comment.
Representative?
I would like to say that there was a situation in my election that there was a statement that had been altered. It did appear in the voter's pamphlet, and it was altered after the individual who had made the statement. And I think that this would prevent us from taking any action, so I have a problem with the way it's written. Bill?
Would you like to contribute any further to this?
Well, I've introduced a bill that is quite different from this one, that I hope will be heard very soon, because what happens is, if you sign the SEL, or you have an individual sign an SEL 400, which is the statement of endorsement form, and that form is turned into a candidate or a committee's headquarters to be submitted with a packet for voter's pamphlet, and that document is altered contrary to the intent or even the person even knowing, and that goes in and goes into the Secretary of State, is printed as in the voter's pamphlet. People rely on that information. They don't know the difference between the required information or the published information. Mm-hmm. And to eliminate the opportunity of the Secretary of State being able to follow up on that, I think, is definitely a disservice to voters.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2578. I am going to refrain from going to a work session on today. I want to talk to Representative Walker more about her concern about that, and perhaps we'll be back to revisit this. All right, I am going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2579. And Ed Dennis?
I forgot to sign up. I'm sorry.
Welcome.
Chair Wilson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ed Dennis. I'm the legislative and redistricting coordinator for Oregon Secretary of State Bill Bradbury. Okay, that's it. So I'm here today to ask for your support on this little bill that, if passed, will help us deal with big future. It's clear to me, and I think to most of us, that we are in the midst of a technological revolution. Things are changing all around us. And I don't know if any of you sat through, I mentioned some of you, a Jim Johnson, he's the Intel site manager, one of his talks on how things are changing technologically. Basically, he goes through in pretty graphic detail about the exponential increase in the Internet in the lives of Americans. And he details that with the amount of servers that are expected to be online, and goes into some specifics about how things are going to change. And in short, I guess, our resolution is that the future is coming and we need to be prepared for it. In the form of this bill, we're suggesting that the state be prudent and thoughtful about our future. But I do want to be clear, the Secretary of State is not suggesting and does not believe that everybody should be voting online in the near future. But instead, that someday soon that option should exist for those that would like to. There are many people in Oregon who probably would take advantage of voting online, when the technology is there to make it safe and easy to vote online and when the state endorses it as such. And just to give you an example, I don't know if any of you have met or heard of Ralph Monroe. He's sort of this legendary Secretary of State from the state of Washington. I don't know, he's been there 15, 20 years, you know, a long time, this guy. And now that he's done being Secretary of State, he's gone into business, and it's internet voting. That's his thing. That's what he's working on. And so it's clear that there are some folks in the industry, if you will, who are looking forward to that. Basically, we believe this. There's a lot to study in this realm. There's the works of others. Several states have already done studies. Several more are hearing legislation similar to this. Oregon needs to review the work that other states are doing and other companies are doing. But we also have to do a study of our own because we're different. Because we utilize vote by mail fully, unlike a state like Washington where it's half vote by mail and half the polling place, Oregon's unique and has our own issues to work out. So there's also been some online experiments done in Arizona and Washington and California, and we also need to study the work that the military has done on internet voting. And I'd just call your attention to another body of work we did not long ago, the centralized voter registration system. You know, we did this big paper, this big report, had it done, and, you know, inside of that we had 7 different options to choose from. We've chosen one option that we felt people could agree on, and now we're attempting to get that option passed through the process this session. So the same is true with this issue. What sorts of issues, what sorts of things do we have to consider in the future or even right now? Should we be working on, should we make considerations with our infrastructure, with our equipment as we replace old equipment? Does the centralized system have anything to do with internet voting, or what does it have to do? Should we do a pilot program, maybe with one county or several precincts? Maybe at the end of this, we'll realize that this is still a long ways away, but that we want to start moving in a direction where we are prepared for that someday. Maybe we'll realize that the most pressing problem is what we do for our men and women who are overseas or going into the military, and maybe we want to try it with them so that we can improve their participation. So we're requesting that we pass this bill, do a study, come back with specific recommendations to the next legislative session about what our state agencies should be doing so that we can stay ahead of the change that is before us. Thank you very much, and I'm here to answer any questions.
Ed, how much money is going to be devoted to this study?
It's 0.25 FTE. Fred, help me out here. Do you know what the number was? Do you know what the actual number was on the fiscal?
Members, it has a minimal fiscal impact, which is more than zero, less than 50,000.
Yeah, so 0.25, I'm thinking around, I'm guessing around 40 or 30. 34. Thank you, Fred.
Any further questions, Representative Doyle?
Thanks. Ed, just looking at Section 1, talking about how the study shall consider, and then it moves on to the different elements that will be considered. I'm a bit concerned that subsection B says how to phase in internet voting as opposed to the question whether to phase it in. And I'm just concerned that language suggests that that's where we're going, and I don't know that question really has been answered yet.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Doyle, I think that our office believes that someday that's where we are going to be. But, you know, whether or not, and maybe even, you know, how to means you've got all these hurdles to overcome first, including, you know, legislative endorsement. That was in our centralized voter registration. You know, we're not going to be able to do it unless legislative leadership says go. I could see either changing the language or leaving it the same, and I think responding adequately to your concern there.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Representative Starr.
Mr. Chair, my only hesitation is what the, you open this box and you don't know where you're maybe going to end up, and I have a real strong hesitancy to to move this debate away from, we've already moved it away from a polling place where we have the part of being a citizen of going to the polls, joining with other members of your community, and collectively casting ballots for our legislative political leadership down the line, to move that from where we don't do that anymore, where moms and dads vote around a kitchen table with maybe or maybe not their kids watching on and seeing this is how we pick our political leaders, to further moving it to where an individual sits in front of a computer at home and punches away on a keyboard and votes. Now, if the end product of that, that's my fear, but if the end product of this was a lottery-type machine, you know, located in various spots around the community where voters went to a screen and punched on the screen, you know, they're voting for X, Y, and Z candidates, and the screen asks, are you sure this is who you want to vote for? And you say yes, and they double-check, and you get a printed copy of a ballot, actual piece of paper, I think is important in this process. Maybe one, two of them, one that you could take home and one that was given to you, put in some kind of a secrecy ballot box. Now that system I can support because in my mind it's actually moving away from that opportunity where there's no interaction, there's no community, there's no voting process that a community does together. So I guess on one hand I'm supportive of the whole concept. On the other hand, where it leads, I guess, is also tends to cause me a little bit of concern, and you can comment on my comments or not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Starr. Indeed, before you got to the end and you had said I'd be in support if we were headed this direction, I was going to suggest that this will reopen that debate because one of the options to look at via Internet voting will be just that sort of, you said lottery, I think ATM machine sort of thing. You know, that will be an option that's discussed because a lot of other states are discussing it right now. And so certainly as we compile the research and the homework that other states are doing, we will look at that as an option. And perhaps we, you know, perhaps it would be suggested that we keep some of the best elements of vote by mail, 2-week window, but we have ATM machines all over the state or something. Now, I don't know, but that's, I don't think a study is going to put us inextricably on track. You know, you guys have dealt with lots of studies, and sometimes they don't really get fully utilized. I think this will open a debate for the next couple of sessions about where it is we're headed.
Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is this expenditure anticipated in the Secretary of State and the Governor's budget?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, Mr. Devlin, no.
Could it be absorbed within the current Secretary of State's budget?
Mr. Chair, Representative Allen, I'm
you're getting a
I'm actually on my way this afternoon. I hope to speak with Dallas, our budget analyst, to talk to him about exactly how many of these little, you know, things are floating underneath the radar screen that are piling up for us. So I'm safe saying no.
Further. All right, thanks much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2579 with no further business to do today.
Committee.